Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 50 years ago, marriage and divorce rates in America were roughly equal among all classes and races. Not anymore. Not even close. When headlines this month announced divorce rates were down to their lowest point in decades, that was true, sort of. They're down for the college-educated and affluent, up for the poor. And marriage itself is becoming the custom of the well-placed in society, a kind of luxury item. We are now a country where a huge portion of the affluent marry and a huge portion of the poor do not. Up next on Point, the marriage gap and what it means for the future of families. Joining me today from Princeton, New Jersey, is David Papineau, founder and co-director of the National Marriage Project at Rutgers University. He's professor emeritus of sociology at Rutgers, author of many books on marriage in America, including his latest, War Over the Family. David Papineau, thank you very much for joining us today.
Nice to be with you.
And joining us from New York is Kay Heimowitz, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. She's author of Marriage and Caste in America, Separate and Unequal Families in a Post-Marital Age. Kay Heimowitz, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
So to both of you, I guess, David, to begin, I mean, it's hard to figure out exactly what's new here, but the headlines keep coming. This trend has been out there for a long, long time, but we saw the divorce headlines earlier this month saying divorce down in America, lowest level since 1970, sounded like a reason to celebrate. Then we lifted the covers, and there's all kinds of stuff going on in here, and a lot of it to do with class. Can you start to walk us in, David, to some of the statistics that illustrate what's going on with marriage and divorce and families in America today?
Well, start with divorce. There has been this big drop, but it turns out that it's almost entirely among the college-educated portion of the population. So the people at the bottom of the class level have actually, their divorce rate has gone up. And if you go back 50 years or more, you find that family life among the poor was very similar to family life among the rich. I mean, for example, before World War II, the black marriage rate was higher than that of the white marriage rate. But lots of things, of course, have happened since then. And another big issue is that college-educated women, a while back, not too long ago, had a hard time finding a guy who would marry them. So that's all changed now, and we have the situation that the college-educated portion of the population is, you might say, zooming ahead in the marriage market with high marriage rates, low divorce rates, and down at the bottom, the opposite is happening.
Kay Heimowitz, how do those rates compare now for the college-educated, the affluent, and the less educated and non-affluent? How do they actually compare? Who's getting married? How often?
Well, it depends whether you're talking about divorce or out of wedlock, childbearing, and I want to bring in that latter point, make sure we understand that. One of the other trends we see, and the other element of this gap, this marriage gap, has to do with the people who are having children outside of marriage. And those, again, tend to be, or probably three times more likely to be, low-income women rather than, and less educated women rather than college-educated women. You may remember not so long ago the Murphy Brown flap. I guess that was in the early 90s.
Getting to be longer and longer ago.
Isn't it? But remember, there was so much controversy over that. Well, it turns out that Murphy Brown was a bit of a Hollywood con. In fact, the professional woman who had her child alone was a rarity and continues to be a rarity, something like under 4%.
But give us more numbers. These are very familiar to you all, but not to us, and we need to hear the case made. What are the levels of children born out of wedlock in different, parts of the American demographic?
Okay, well, let's start with the black numbers, which are have been alarming for a long time. 70% of black children are born to unmarried mothers.
70%, 70.
Yes, correct, 70%. The numbers for Hispanics are close to about 50% these days, and seem to be rising. That's a number we want to keep an eye on. Among whites, I think it's closer to, David perhaps will be able to help us with that. I've forgotten the exact number.
It's about 26%.
26% of children of white couples born out of wedlock at this point. And is that up, David, or is that steady?
It's fairly steady. I mean, the overall national average now is 37% for everybody. And so all those various things filter down to that average.
And this comes, of course, because some people get married and some don't. And what about the simple marriage numbers? I mean, what percentage of college-educated people are getting married versus people further down the education or income schedule? David Kay, I don't know who's got that.
Well, I can tell you that the Census Bureau predicts that about 90% or close to 90% of all women will marry eventually. How many of those are college educated or not? I don't actually know. But the interesting thing is that we are still a marrying country in many ways, much more so than a lot of other countries, developed countries. But it's not necessarily that children come before the marriage, so that you'll see a lot of women who do have children out of wedlock who will eventually marry. The numbers are lower for black women, I believe, over a lifetime. It's more like, I think it's somewhere around 65% of women, black women, will marry eventually. But 90% of women will marry eventually.
But 90% is not the picture that we're being given here when it comes to marriage and its applicability when people are making families. I mean, David, help me out here. What I'm reading is that you've got now kind of an affluent America that's marrying hand over fist and staying married longer, and a poor, uneducated America that's not. What are the numbers that prove that, David?
Well, I think the numbers that we've given you do a pretty good job. Probably the percent of people who will ever marry is down to now 85. Of course, it's hard to – it's a projection ahead, so you don't really know. But I think that the college-educated crowd probably is still marrying at the 90% figure, and the lower down, they're marrying probably at the 80% figure. But remember that these figures that we're giving you are marrying at any one time, and, of course, you have a much higher breakup rate down in the lower levels of the class structure. So that's why you get this situation where you have so many out of wedlock births.
And families where marriage just doesn't come before childbearing, Kay Heimowitz. I mean, it's kind of put the other way around. What I'm reading you and others saying is among certain sectors of society, marriage is seen as perhaps coming after childbirth and not necessarily to the father of the first children.
Yeah, that's actually one of my main points, is that we've seen a real disconnect over the last 40 years between marriage and childbearing. Somewhere around 1980, if you look at the trend lines, college-educated women began to get the idea that maybe that wasn't such a good idea for the children, and the children would be better off growing up with the two married parents. And the divorce rate began to go down among those women. That did not happen among the less educated women. By the way, you've been asking for figures, and let me give you this. Mm-hmm. By the year 2000, 10% of mothers with a college degree or more were living without husbands, and that's as opposed to 36% of those without a college degree. Mm. So it's over three times as likely for a child growing up with a mother who has no college degree to be living without a father.
And here's a couple of figures that really struck me. 92% of children whose families make more than $75,000 a year live with two parents, whereas at the bottom of the income scale, families earning less than $15,000, and that is way down there, only 20% of children live with two parents. That sounds like a marriage gap from a child's perspective, Kay.
That's right. And remember that a lot of those children who are at the lower end are probably children of immigrants, of low-skilled immigrants, who, if things work out the way they have in the past, will see their incomes go up in the future.
David, why is this happening? I mean, I'm also looking here at the divorce rate among college-educated women going way down. Of those who got married between 1975 and 79, 29% were divorced within 10 years. In 1990 to 1994, those who got married then, 10 years later, only 16% were divorced. Why are the affluent getting married in greater numbers and staying married longer? Why are the less educated and the poor not embracing marriage?
Well, the affluent are getting married in greater numbers, for as Kay says, they see it's a good deal in life and they're able to do it.
What's the proof of that, that it's a good deal in life?
Well, I think they've gotten the message that married people tend to be happier, healthier, live longer, wealthier, and so on. They know it's best for children. And, you know, I think that the fact that that message has gotten around after the sort of happenings of the 60s and 70s is an important part of this piece.
Why aren't the poor sharing in that same message? We're all reading the same magazines, more or less.
Well, there's another sort of thread of modern culture, and that is tolerance of alternative lifestyles, family diversity, and so on. And that's what's really filtered down to the lower classes, I think. What you see in Hollywood movies and television, where marriage is typically not looked at particularly favorable. Everybody's breaking up. Everybody's sleeping with everybody else, and so on. And you get the sense that that really is the message that has stamped itself on the lower classes.
Is it really cultural, though, David, that you're describing there, or is it economic, that they don't feel that they're in a position to afford married life?
Well, they were an awful lot poorer before World War II when they were married in large numbers, so it can't be entirely economic, but obviously there is an economic element.
We're talking this hour about the marriage gap, America's affluent embracing marriage, America's poor increasingly waiting or rejecting, and what that means for the future of families in this country. We've been joined from Princeton, New Jersey, by David Papineau at the National Marriage Project at Rutgers University. Kay Heimowitz has joined us from the Manhattan Institute in New York City. Right now we're joined as well by Ronald Mincy, professor of social policy and social work practice at Columbia University, editor of Black Males Left Behind. Ronald Mincy, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ronald Mincy, we've begun to wade in here. I'd love to get your perspective. It's been a long time since Daniel Patrick Moynihan came out with his big report in 1965 talking about a tangle of pathologies in African-American families. But now we see, you know, there, yes, but right across American culture, kind of along income lines, real distinctions in how people are relating to marriage. What do you see going on here?
Well, I think even before Daniel Patrick Moynihan got to this, there were African-American sociologists who worried about this tangle of pathologies. And it is certainly the case that declines in marriage are spreading quite generally across our society, especially among young people of childbearing age. And so the age at first marriage has increased substantially into the 26, 27-year-old for men, to 24 to 5-year-old for women, and it is particularly low among those who have not gone to college. And so I think this has very broad implications for our society generally, especially when we think of child well-being and inequality and factors like that.
David Papineau says 50 years ago, people of all classes and races got married in essentially the same proportions. If that has changed so dramatically now, what kind of consequences do you foresee, Ronald Mincy?
Well, I think, first of all, we did tend to have lower marriage rates among less educated people, and this is peculiarly the case for blacks. So marriage was quite common for blacks with higher education, but common law marriages were quite common for those who had not gone to college, and then you had a lot of marital instability even among those who were married. So, but
are you saying there's nothing new here?
For the African American population, it is. There is something new, because even among historically among African Americans who didn't marry, there was a lot of cohabitation. There were common law marriages, and they tended to be more or less stable over time. Now, however, 70% of African American children are born, or nearly 70%, are born to unmarried parents, and they are much less likely than whites to cohabit. So, what is common now is for African-American children to be born to couples who are not residing together, and as a result, children are much likely to benefit from having two of the same parents over their life course. And one of the things we do know is that instability in parenting arrangements is not good for children. And so in those respects, African-American children are going to be sort of left behind as a consequence of that. But again, the important thing to point out is that this is now a quite common phenomenon in our society generally.
Not just among African-Americans.
It's quite general.
We've heard that. Kay gave us the numbers for Hispanics and for whites. Kay Heimowitz, you write what you call, you write about a new caste system emerging on the back of this this development. What do you mean?
Well, we now know from decades of research that children who grow up with their married parents are in a better shape for going to school, for graduating from high school. They're more likely to go to college, and if they do go to college, they're more likely to go to an elite college. They're at less risk of all sorts of problems, ranging from drug use to early sexual activities. The children of married parents are also more likely than to get their college degree, and they are more likely to marry before they have children. That is, those children of married parents are doing better. If you look at the other end, if you look at the children of the unmarried or single mothers, they are more likely to drop out of school or to have less success in school. And they're more likely to become single parents themselves. So that means this is a kind of self-perpetuating situation that we have here, and that's why I refer to it as a caste system.
Self-perpetuating, so you imagine generation after generation falling into the same sort of part of the demographic and income spectrum.
Well, if we look at what's happened in the past, and if we look at the data on what to expect of children from these different arrangements, yes, that's what I think could happen.
I want to begin to turn to our listeners. John's calling from Westboro, Massachusetts. John, what do you see?
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to bring up two points. There used to be more of a stigma attached to having sex before marriage and consequently having, of course, children before marriage. Also, if you have two parents, you, at least at this time, you'll have two incomes and therefore more wealth.
Absolutely. So if that's so obvious, why would people not want to go down that road?
Well, you know, I think the what gets complicated here is, you know, who benefits from marriage. It's clear that, that children do better in married couple families when they've been raised by both of their parents throughout their life course. It's also clear that men in many dimensions do better, but it's not so clear for women. That is to say, if you look at income, health status, it's not clear that that women who are unmarried are less well off than women who are. And in a way, when we're talking about marriage, obviously women have a strong choice to make here. So I think that's part of the disconnect, that over time the gains to marriage, especially for women, have fallen as men's earnings have declined. And so when you ask yourself who is marrying, it's men and women at the higher tail of the educational distribution, and that's why marriage rates are higher there, although they're delayed. If you look at less educated men and women, those who have not gone to college, we know that the earnings of men have not grown in 25 years, and therefore the gains to marriage for less educated women are not as high. And for that reason, that is part of the reason, in addition to some other factors. I'm sure others will talk about, our marriage rates have declined over time.
David Papineau, do you agree that lower-income women just don't have as big a stake in marriage as high-income women because the men they're likely to marry aren't as likely to bring a big income with them?
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable proposition. I wouldn't go quite as far as Ron, I guess, in suggesting that marriage is so much better for men than it is for women, but it is true that a man who doesn't earn money still in this day and age is not someone that a woman wants to marry, whereas a woman who doesn't earn money is usually no problem for a man, although increasingly, by the way, men want to marry women who do bring money into the couple.
And when you bring in a couple of healthy incomes, you're doing all right in this society. I guess, Kay, that's part of the reason that the affluent aren't breaking up. I mean, the numbers, the divorce decline seems absolutely not only the clearest there, I guess it's only there among the better off. How do you explain that? Is it financial? People don't want to bust up a good thing? Or is this a generation that saw their parents get divorced and they don't want to follow that?
Well, I think there is some of that, actually. It's a kind of reaction to the earlier generation, the ice storm generation, as I sometimes refer to it. But it's not only that. I think also what happened is that we now know that kids really need to get a college education in order to thrive in this economy. Now, to get a kid through high school and then into college and through college is a very, very a big proposition, a very difficult, very expensive proposition. And I think for most college-educated women who themselves have an college education and know what's involved, they are less likely to want to see that marriage break up to, and more likely to put the emphasis on the on getting those kids through college and educated and through college. And it is also possible that educated women and men, for that matter, have stronger skills, better skills for solving problems and that sort of thing.
We'll look at how those skills might be spread, but let's take a call from Italy, from Turin, Italy. We've got Joe on the line. Hi, Joe. You're way off. What do you know?
Hi, how's it going, man? Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. I was just going to say something along the same lines as what's been said pretty much before. I come from a pretty poor background, although I am Italian-American, a first-generation immigrant. And I've seen the struggles that my family's had to go through to keep the marriage together as far as my mother and father goes. But I've also seen the benefits of confronting the realities of their marriage with my own persona. And I've also had less psychological damage to deal with in terms of getting that out of the way and clearing my own head for the challenges that lie ahead of me in terms of
so. So your family was poor, Joe, but the marriage held together, and you see it working for you.
Yeah, because I don't have as much of a psychological hurdle to overcome as far as understanding dynamics of relationships and love, even though they're. Relationship isn't exactly perfect. Nobody's is, but at least I have a chance to see up close and criticize up close as far as what goes on between the two of them, and I can make my own modifications and go into a relationship of my own with confidence in the future.
There's a vote from the poor side of the ledger saying, "Stick with it," and it worked for Joe calling in from Italy. Let's get another call from Brookline, Massachusetts. Firkins is on the line. Firkins, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I love your show.
Thanks.
I'm building on a point that was you were starting to make a minute ago, and it's about why some of the more economically well-off families stay together. Mm. I work in the inner city. I live in the suburbs, in a wealthy suburb, and I've noticed that some of the families in the suburbs, even in marriages that aren't especially happy, yes, they know that staying together is better for the kids, but we'll often stay together because you don't have to sort of divide your assets and thereby divide your lifestyle.
Sure.
And sort of give that away. And people are reluctant to do that, so they're sort of staying married, if you will, for kind of negative reasons.
And on the other side of that equation, Firkins, in the inner city where you work, is it the opposite? There's less to lose, so off we go.
Well, actually, I want to make one more point.
I think it
connects more to the cities. Also, you know, we live these lives. I'm in a happy marriage, but we don't have family near us. We both work. It's really hard. Like, to imagine being divorced or separated and trying to raise our families without the family support around us, you know, it's really, you know, daunting. And I think it's another reason. I wonder, you know, what the research shows, if that's part of a reason that families, wealthier families, stay together, because they tend to be more mobile, tend to be away from their extended families.
That's an interesting observation. Let us pick it up, Firkins. Ronald Mincy, let me come to you with that. Do we have patterns that support?
Yeah, I just wanted to suggest that, you know, I don't think we have, you know, two different, very different or different sets of behaviors going on among the highly educated and the less educated. We also know that rates of cohabitation are rising among those who attend college and the like. So we also have, you know, high rates of cohabitation among most women who attend college, and then they tend to transition to marriage at faster rates than women who don't, who have lower levels of education. So there's a lot of cohabitation occurring even among the educated population, but they tend to transition to marriage later on. But I think that also informs us about why divorce rates have stabilized and declined at the top end of the educational distribution. When you have cohabiting couples who choose not to marry,
mm-hmm.
those are some of the bad marriages of 25 years ago. Okay, so at 25 years ago, there would be a real stigma against not marrying, and as a result, you would have had more lower quality marriages occurring in the first place, and then 5 years later, those couples would be divorced. Today, what you have is couples living together, discovering, nope, this really is not going to work. As a consequence, we won't marry, and those are the marriages that you don't observe divorcing today.
So
these are complicated phenomena, but I do think, you know, the basic point is that married people have higher levels of income, they blend their resources more completely than non-married couples and the like, and as a consequence, they have more resources with which to invest in their children, and they have fewer children, and as a consequence, they invest more deeply in the kids they have.
And the advantages...
That is going to produce these multiple and complicated levels of inequality over time as the children of married couple families get more and more and more, and those of less of unmarried couples get less.
With advantages multiplying right there. David Papineau, for all that, you've said that you see the institution of marriage generally in trouble in this country. Now, why is that?
You know, before I answer that, let me just add one point about the gap, and that's the fertility gap, which Ron alluded to. It's important to point out that college-educated women have fewer children than those down below. One study found recently that college-educated women in their 40s, 25% of them have no children whatsoever, versus only 16% of those down at the lower class levels and less lower educational levels. So that's a big factor in all of this, and also it's problematic for the future, since presumably these college-educated people aren't going to be replacing themselves. Their fertility is way under the replacement level right now as it is.
So as a nation, we're looking at this bastion of marriage as a shrinking bastion.
Well, that's the way I see it, and that's certainly what's happened in Europe, where cohabitation has gradually taken over, especially in the northern European countries. Marriage rates are far lower than in the United States. We gave the figure before of 85% or so of Americans expected to eventually marry. In some European nations, now it's only 60%.
Is there some price being paid for that, or they're living with it just fine, thank you?
Well, I don't think they are living with it just fine. Of course, they have all the safety nets in the European nations, which is an enormous help on the economic front. But
social welfare systems and all.
Exactly. And but it's not so much help, if any, on the psychological front. So, yeah, you're finding a lot of, you know, sort of more of these benign psychological issues rising in these countries. And I think that's probably what we will be seeing here more of in the future, too.
Do you see the U.S. following that trend, that increasing decline in the overall marriage rate?
Well, I do. It's, you know, we are the exception in many ways. But I think rather than the exception, we're really more the laggard. Our marriage rate is, our cohabitation rate is gradually going up, and the European cohabitation rate has leveled off now, and I don't think it'll be too long before we equalize. By the way, the divorce rates in Europe now are almost the equivalent of those in the United States. So we seem to have in modern nations a situation where marriage, shall we say, is not going to be the winner.
We're talking this hour about the marriage gap. Ron Mincy is with us from Columbia University, David Papineau from the National Marriage Project at Rutgers University, and Kay Heimowitz from the Manhattan Institute. She's written Marriage and Caste in America, Separate and Unequal Families in a Post-Marital Age. Let's take a call from Walpole, Massachusetts, and Janine. Hi, Janine. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
I'm calling with a question more about the kind of generational cycle that they see where single parents households, the children do not have marriages in their future.
Mm-hmm. They sort of model on the split, divided family or unmarried family, and it goes again.
Exactly, mm-hmm. exactly. And my question, coming from a household where it was a single mother, is if it's not possible that single parent is not conveying a sense of hostility towards the marriage situation, so that the children have a poor sense of marriage and they don't want to perpetuate it in their own lives.
Ronald Mincy, how about it? Do we have a message being sent that clearly from unmarried parents to their kids? Hostility.
Well, I think parental attitudes toward marriage are being transferred to kids, but I wouldn't sort of restrict it in the same way the caller did. So first of all, the children of divorce are much less confident of their ability to maintain and sustain a marital relationship over their life course, and that's one of the reasons why our marriage rates are falling.
You mean less confident than children whose parents were never married, or
no,
less?
No, I don't mean to say that, but less confident than the children of parents who sustained a happy marriage or a healthy marriage throughout their life course.
Mm-hmm.
So again, you know, there are differences, but I want us to avoid making these hard and fast judgments as if there are two separate worlds. Again, the divorce rates have stabilized at 50%, but that means that 50% of children in America will experience a separation in their biological parents over time. And those children who are the children of divorce are themselves less likely to marry, and they sort of join this other population of kids who were never married. But the difference between, with respect to children of non-marital parents, they don't have models of how to manage. They don't see compromise and the working out of relationships between men and women over time, and that may well deter their likelihood of marrying over time or their likelihood of having a successful marriage because they haven't seen that model. Then you don't. And as a society, we in many ways take the institution of marriage for granted, and that's the larger problem. How can a variety of institutions that influence the way people behave begin to, first of all, make the public aware of the benefits of marriage for men, women, for men, women, and children? And then secondly, how can we begin to learn what it is that sustains a successful marriage so that people, A, will want to do it and then have the skill set to do so?
Well, what about that question? I'm reading here, you know, of course, President Bush has put some money, a couple of $100 million, I think, into promoting marriage. Oklahoma stepped up with a big public campaign to support marriage. 100,000 people attended workshops since it began in 2001. And the latest divorce figures in Oklahoma, no drop. And Oklahoma has a high divorce rate. So what works when it comes to supporting marriage, Professor Mincy?
Well, again, what we're doing now is taking resources and taking curricula and other sorts of services to sustain marriage that have been used in the military and that have been used in a very particular population, and then adapting them to a more generic population. We've only been doing this for at the operational level for a little less than a year since the Deficit Reduction Act was passed in order to put these resources in the field, and as yet it's too early to tell how well or how poorly it's going to be working. However, I do think it is an important investment for the government to be making, because it's very clear, for all the reasons that the earlier speaker suggested, that children of marital couples do better, and we want to have more children exposed to that. And I think it is absolutely critical among African Americans, where marriage is quite frankly rare.
Kay Heimowitz, I want to get deeper into the sort of cultural attitudes here, and there's economics writing behind everything, we understand. But I'm looking here at a column that David Brooks, conservative columnist at the New York Times, admirer of yours, wrote back in January. He was citing a study by Andrew Cherlin at Johns Hopkins, saying that poorer Americans regard marriage not as the foundation of adult life, not where you begin, but as the capstone, something you strive toward but maybe are never quite able to afford. That childbearing often comes just routinely before marriage and on purpose. It's not an accident, but that childbearing comes first and the hope of marriage is out there, but then many people feel they can never quite afford it. They're never quite prepared for it.
Well, that's right, and I'm glad you brought in this cultural issue, because I think it plays such an important role here. One of the things that culture teaches people is what I call the life script. That is, it tells its citizens, this is the way we live our lives. And the life script in the past, and the middle-class life script today, is that you go through your childhood, and then you have your adolescence, which involves training for work, whether that be just through high school vocational training or medical school. only then, when you are self-sufficient or ready for self-sufficiency, do you marry, and only then do you have children. That is the middle-class life script. Now, that script was smashed by the 1970s, when the idea that you needed to marry before having children really began to fade away. As I've said before, I think middle-class women picked up fairly quickly that it was a better idea to wait till you were married to have your kids. And unfortunately, it's not as clear to low-income women. And if you talk to a lot of them, they will say that, yes, they got pregnant with a guy, a boyfriend. Almost all low-income women who have children are romantically attached to their partners at the time of the baby's birth. But that they, they didn't think it was necessary to be married first, or, that marriage was something else. It wasn't really connected to having children.
But what about the economic piece? If that man has an income that's not advancing, maybe, the couple just doesn't feel that they've got the resources to live out what they visualize as the married life.
Well, the problem with that explanation, and I'm sure it plays some role, but again, it has to do with a change in our understanding of what marriage is. In other words, those women are saying, if your interpretation is correct, that marriage is about more economic stability. It's not about having two parents raising the child. And ironically, if you compare low-income people of similar educations and similar backgrounds who are married as opposed to those who are not, you will find that the married parents of the who are low-income are better off in a variety of ways, and their children are going to be better off. So that economic explanation, to me, is problematic, because if that were true, then we really wouldn't see any advantages to being married, but we do.
Let's go to Augusta, Georgia, and Beth. Hi, Beth. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know if any connections have been made between the low-income class and those that are on, government subsidies, such as Medicaid, welfare, food stamps, that sort of thing, because most of those programs don't encourage the father to necessarily be in the picture. More money is received if it's a single mother with multiple children. I'm curious if any of that has been shown through the research and, analyzing this marriage gap.
But didn't we end welfare as we know it a decade ago under Bill Clinton, Beth? I mean, is that dynamic still working?
Well, I think that when you think about, I'm talking welfare as in a general sense, such as Medicaid, those that are low income and qualify for those sort of things, not necessarily that specific program.
Yeah. Let us pick it up, Beth, and thank you for your call. David Papineau, how about it? Is government policy supporting marriage, or subtly or not so subtly discouraging it?
Well, certainly supporting marriage a lot more in this country than it is in Europe. We have, as the famous, more than 1,000 rights and responsibilities that married couples get at the federal level. The interesting thing is that welfare reform, which is now, 5 years old, has had a lot of effects, but it hasn't really affected marriage much. There hasn't been any great increase in marriage among those at the bottom, which suggests that it really is, as a lot of us here have been saying, more of a cultural phenomenon than it is an economic one.
Even when you make welfare harder to get, people are not going to be drawn to marriage. What do you say, Ronald?
But what is really clear is that welfare reform is lowering the rate of increase in non-marital births. There's no question about that. And so to the extent that I believe that there is evidence that we know historically that welfare has lowered rates of marriage among whites. It tends not to lower rates of marriage among blacks, curiously. And we also know that since welfare has become more difficult to get and more difficult to keep because of the welfare reform in 1996, that rates of non-marital births have stopped increasing, where they had been doing so for decades. And so these changes in public policy are lowering the rate of non-marital births, and I think that's very, very important.
So then,
and we also, with the 1996 reform, began to explicitly adopt public policies that would facilitate and encourage marriage, and began an important dialogue in the United States as to whether or not it is the responsibility of government to provide incentives and to support for marriage. And I think it's going to be certainly where many people are looking at the evaluations of these marriage programs which are underway and are very interested in, you know, how this public policy agenda shapes up, particularly when it's likely that, you know, the Democrats will control the House and we may have a change in administrations. And will we be supporting and continuing to learn how government can help to support marriage after there's a change in regime?
Well, what kind of support are you referring there to, Professor Mincy?
For example, the low-income and minority people I know who are enrolled in the Healthy Marriage Demonstration Projects in Baltimore, for example, have said that they enjoy and welcome these initiatives because it is the first time they have had an opportunity to learn how to manage their relationships better.
And this is not marriage therapy. This is you just go in and sort of talk about how marriage can work, ought to work.
These are relationship education programs that help couples who want to marry understand how to communicate with one another, how to manage difficulties and conflicts in their relationships, and the like.
The military does it, and now a bunch of cities trying it as well through the program.
That's right. So, and I think, again, it's going to be important to evaluate what these interventions mean for the quality of the relationships there, whether or not marriages actually occur, and whether or not relationships and marriages last longer after having experienced anything. These things are just generally not available to poor people, and now they are. And I think it's an important part of what we've got to learn.
Let's go to Mattapan, Massachusetts, and Fatima. Fatima, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you see, Fatima?
I was raised in the inner city, and I also work in the inner city.
Yeah.
I'm actually en route to Columbia University.
Good for you.
Thank you.
Way to go.
Basically calling to say that I feel if we're going to look at the cultural dynamics of why having children is accepted and why marriage isn't really accepted within the inner city community, we would have to look at the social norms. And it is socially normal for people in the inner city to have kids out of wedlock and continue this ongoing cycle of not getting married because it's not looked at as a big deal.
Why not get married? I mean, why avoid it? You know it. You've lived it. Why not?
I don't feel that it's a matter of them avoiding it, but I also feel that it's a matter of them not being exposed to it. As someone said before, if you're not used to being raised in a home which has both parents, then it's not going to be necessarily the social norm for you. It might be the social norm for someone who was raised in, let's say, Chestnut Hill, Mass., for example.
Affluent town, yeah.
Yes, which is considered a rich suburban neighborhood, and it's the social norm there. I also went to Mount St. Joseph Academy, which is a Catholic school. I went there for 1 year, and it wasn't socially acceptable to have a child or a student with pregnant in high school.
Sure. Yeah. Fatima, let me ask you, because, you know, you've scrambled up the ladder, and good for you in doing it, raised on the tough side and headed off to Columbia. How do you look at marriage? You, personally, do you expect to be married before you start a family?
Yes, I'm definitely a strong supporter of being married before I start a family. My mother and father are both still married. I was raised by the both of them. And I personally don't find it acceptable for myself to have children out of wedlock. And that's my take on it. As far as circumstances occurring, I try not to put myself in that situation, and I think it's mainly because I have a mother and a father.
Right, but the norm you've seen around you is quite different from that.
Exactly.
Yep.
Pretty much. And I think if you don't live in that type of environment, then you're not going to look at it as a big thing. I mean, if your mother had you out of wedlock, who is she to tell you that you can't have a child out of wedlock?
Yeah, Fatima, you're great, and we wish you the very best of luck. Congratulations to you. David Papineau, you know, there's the voice speaking straight to us about the difficulty of changing this. How does it get changed? Is it enough to hold some counseling sessions for, you know, couples around the country, or is there something else we could do?
Well, to be frank, we don't really know. If we knew, we'd probably start doing it. But I do think that the switch on the part of the government, which Ron was talking about, is extremely important, because for the first time, a wide spectrum of people across all class and educational levels are talking about the value of marriage, and this used to be the case 25 or 30 years ago. And so, as you can see, it really is a question of somehow changing those norms.
Do you give credit to George W. Bush for this? I mean, he pushed for the pro-marriage counseling programs we're talking about.
Right. Well, it was really one specific person in his administration by the name of Wade Horn that was the, the author of all of this stuff. But he was he himself was part of a sort of a marriage movement which has been emerging in America in the last few decades. So, you know, I think that gets some credit, too.
Well, it's quite a big and complex picture, but we see a society in the midst of big changes. We hope we don't head toward a caste system here, as you put it, Kay Heimowitz, but the stakes are clearly high. I want to thank each of you for being with us this hour. Kay at the Manhattan Institute, senior fellow there, author of Marriage and Caste in America. Kay Heimowitz, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Ronald Mincy, professor of social policy and social work practice at Columbia University, editor of Black Males Left Behind. Ron, thanks very much for being
here.
Thank
you.
And David Papineau, always good speaking with you there at the National Marriage Project at Rutgers University. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks a lot.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.